Greetings and welcome to Lobes and Robes, How Neuroscience Can Change the World. This podcast is sponsored by the American University Center for Neuroscience and Behavior and explores the links between neuroscience and key policy questions today. I'm Susan Carl, a professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, and I will help lead discussions throughout our series along with Dr. Terry Davidson, Director of the Center for Neuroscience and Behavior at American University and a distinguished professor of neuroscience here. This podcast is for anyone interested in how scientific discovery can make the world a better place. Thanks for listening.
It is my great pleasure to introduce our guest today, Dr. Colin Saldana, who is professor in the Department of Neuroscience at American University and a charter member of AU's Center for Neuroscience Behavior. Colin earned his doctorate in psychology from Columbia University, followed by postdoctoral research position at UCLA, where he developed his current specialization in neuroendocrinology. He is widely known for his research on the actions of estrogen and other hormones on reproductive, aggressive, affiliative, and rewarding behaviors, as well as the modulation of memory, social behaviors, and the protection of the brain from injury. Colin has published extensively in high-profile scientific journals, and his work has been funded by both the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. Based on his research expertise and his reputation as a world-renowned scholar, Colin was chosen to serve as the program director in the Neural Systems Cluster of the Division of Integrative and Organismal Biology at the National Science Foundation, position he held from 2018 to 2021. In this position, Colin helped oversee the next generation of research sponsored by that agency. I'm also pleased to say that Colin has been my esteemed colleague at American University for the past 10 years. Thank you, Colin, for joining us today on our podcast.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Terry, and for your kind words.
Could you introduce yourself to our listeners, what kind of research you do, and what led you to the research interests that you now have?
Certainly. So members of my laboratory and I are very curious about how hormones are delivered to specific targets at the right time and at the right dose. My interest in this question came about during graduate school, where it became obvious to the scientific community that an individual hormone, take estrogen for example, modulates a whole bunch of different behaviors. It's not just for female reproduction. It's now found in the brain, synthesized in the brain. It is known, of course, for its role in reproduction, but also aggression, mood, memory, energy balance, obesity, and several other behaviors. So the question in my head was, how can one hormone do all these different things and not cause what I call cross-circuit meltdowns? It suggests that there are mechanisms that make the right amount of hormone available to the right target at the right time and excludes other targets. That is what our laboratory studies.
When you say cross-circuit meltdowns, could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. I'll use a fairly ridiculous argument just to make the point here. We know that ovulation in the human female occurs approximately once every 28 days. And that is the peak of estrogen during the cycle. We also know that estrogen lowers the threshold for neuronal firing, and that can cause seizures. So if you follow that argument to its ridiculous end, women ought to be having seizures once every 28 days. And they don't. In fact, there's a horrible condition called catamenial epilepsy, but that's very, very uncommon relative to the fact that millions of women do not suffer from this cross-circuit meltdown. That's what I mean.
As a layperson, just a couple of questions. So is estrogen something that's just found in the female brain, or is it in the male brain too, but less of it? And what about testosterone, the male hormone? You know, I'm just wondering about the relationship between them, and do they interact?
Well, they absolutely do. So in the female, the main source of estrogens, it's a group name actually, but we'll refer to just the one estrogen, is the ovary. However, in the early 1980s, it was discovered that the brain itself is capable of synthesizing estrogen. And then the stunner was that it's the male brain that makes more estrogen than the female brain. This was very surprising to the scientific community, but it has been replicated over and over again. Also, the synthesis of estrogen happens only by the conversion of testosterone to estrogen. So testosterone can be considered the substrate which is acted on by an enzyme and converted to estradiol. So in females have to make testosterone in order to make estrogens. In males, testosterone circulates at a higher level in the body because the male has very little of this enzyme that converts testosterone to estrogen in the body itself. In the brain, however, this enzyme exists at high levels. And so the male brain can convert testosterone that's circulating in the body to estrogens just in the brain alone.
That is just so fascinating. It sounds so complex.
So are these differences confined to humans or are they observed in all vertebrate species?
I think it's safe to say that they have been found in every vertebrate species that has been looked at. Now, there are variations in the amount of aromatase, this enzyme that converts testosterone to estradiol. There are variations in the amount and the location in the brain of this enzyme across species. But I think it is safe to say that it has been found in every single species that we've looked at.
Yeah. So the difference between male and female brains isn't what hormones are there, but whether they cycle or not. And what are the other sort of key differences, given that there's some of all of these hormones in both kinds of brains, but what are the key differences?
When the neuroendocrinologists first started studying this, you nailed the point. They were looking for what causes the male brain to tell the male body not to cycle. So yes, you're right. There's a cycle in females and there is no cycle in males. In terms of the differences, we now know that the brain has the capability of making every single steroid that is necessary in order to reach the final product that is estrogens. So there are variations in the amount of aromatase in the brain, this enzyme. There are variations in the location of this enzyme in the brain. There are some animals, like the animals I study, that make huge amounts of estrogens just in their brains. Mammals, not so much. It's constrained to a few limbic loci, parts of the brain, old parts of the brain.
So, Colin, it indicates that there are a lot of similarities in the hormonal background of male and female brains. Yet, aren't there differences as well in terms of, well, not necessarily hormonal differences, but just differences in maybe brain structure, function, or not?
There absolutely are. And sex differences are fairly pervasive across the entire vertebrate class, vertebrate group. I'll focus on humans just for now. In the 1980s and 1990s, there was a whole bunch of papers published looking at male and female structural differences in the brain using magnetic resonance imagery. We found out that the corpus callosum, the connection between the cerebrum, was thicker in females compared to males. Also, there was a structure called a splenium, which is one end of the corpus callosum, that is more bulbous in females relative to males. We don't really know what the functions of all these structural differences are as of yet, but it is true that they have been pointed out and replicated by many scientists.
So does that then mean if you look at an MRI of a brain, you can for sure tell whether it's a female or a male brain?
No, I'm glad you asked that question. The structural differences emerge when you average the size of many, many, many brains. female brains on average have a thicker corpus callosum than male brains on average. But there is considerable overlap. So you would not be able to tell with 100% certainty if you just looked at an MRI image.
So Colin, are these differences, would you call them, say, pre-wired at birth, or would they develop based on experience? What do you think produces those differences?
Yeah. So it seems, from the way we understand it now, there are differences in the genome. We've all heard of this. The males are XY, females are XX. And we have learned that there is a sequence on the Y chromosome, which, if present, causes the gonad of the embryo to develop into a testis. And this testis begins secreting testosterone. This is during gestation. That testosterone seems to be critical and important for making many, many, many other structures in the body and the brain to look more male-like. So, for example, testosterone makes the genitalia of a male look different from the genitalia of a female. This also works in the brain, where testosterone, once it enters the brain, has effects on neural circuits. So I think it is fair to say that there are genetic differences that result in hormonal differences, and these hormonal differences in turn cause sex differences in structure and function.
Okay. I mean, obviously, at the level that you can speak to me, at least, about all of this, we're just going to get a very superficial understanding of all of this amazing complexity. But I'm wondering, where do you see the primary sort of medical and healthcare applications of what you're discovering? Is it too soon to really make any kinds of interventions at that level, or are there some things that we know that can actually result in human beings' lives being better?
Sadly, it has only been in the last decade or so that the National Institutes of Health have insisted on adding females to the subject groups. Believe it or not, until about 10 years ago, the vast majority of medical research was done in males, only males. And what that translated to, unfortunately, is some tragic events in terms of pharmaceuticals, because we did not know that females process pharmaceuticals differently compared to males. Not all pharmaceuticals, but certainly some. The work that I do in my laboratory is very, very far removed from actual applications. But the work that is going on in many mammalian labs, as well as human research subject labs, is a little closer. Unfortunately, we are just beginning to understand how the female body actually functions in terms of so many of these medical questions. We hope to have many answers sooner rather than later to avoid these tragedies that we have seen happen in the last few decades.
So now we're paying attention, basically, and we haven't been. As you know, also, even animal research is the same thing. We have to look at males and females, and not only just put them together in studies, but we have to compare them directly, whatever, anything we're measuring. And this has also led to some discoveries that we just didn't know were there before this was required. One of the things I guess I'm interested in is, so there are differences. What are the functional consequences? So you probably remember where there used to be things like, well, females aren't as good at math as males. My own PhD advisor, her name was Elizabeth Capaldi. She happened to finish her degree in mathematics when she was 16 at Rochester University. So that kind of put, it's certainly not a broad, something you apply broadly. But are there any particular things that, with respect to mental and behavioral functioning, that would separate or identify males versus females?
Again, I don't think it would identify males or females, but there certainly are differences on average in several behaviors. I'll give you a couple of examples. So it is true that on average, men do better on calculations than females do. On average, there is a huge amount of overlap, and your PhD advisor would certainly fall in there. Another set of behaviors that we loosely refer to as rough and tumble play. It's exactly what you think the term means, rolling around, wrestling, sort of play fighting with each other. Those sorts of behaviors are seen much more in males relative to females. And now I'm talking about younger boys. So yes, females do not participate in as much rough and tumble play as do males. However, again, there is a lot of overlap. So you would not be able to just look at an individual playing and say, oh, this is a boy or this is a girl, for sure. But if you watched many, many, many boys and averaged the amount of play that they participated in that was rough and tumble play, it would be higher in boys compared to girls.
So one thing it seems to be difficult to sort out is, and I think a lot of the history, the idea was, well, if you believe that boys are better at math, you're going to create an environment that kind of makes that self-fulfilling prophecy. The same kind of thing maybe with rough and tumble play. So to what extent do you think biology relative to culture is generating these kinds of differences?
You're absolutely right to point out that there is a huge amount of interaction between biology and culture. However, if you look at animals, non-human primates, monkeys, even there, males participate in more rough and tumble play than females. So although there may be some influence of culture in humans, you can see this pattern in non-humans as well, suggesting that there is some very important biology going on.
I remember reading a study that looked at the development of intelligence testing in the United States and the way that early on, differences were seen, especially developmentally in girls and boys, and when certain kinds of intelligence kicked in, especially around verbal stuff. And there, the girls were ahead of the boys. And so, of course, the people doing the study said, well, that can't be right. We have to renorm our measuring instruments to make sure that boys and girls don't come out differently. So, you know, sometimes I wonder about the continued operation of some of those assumptions, you know, in what's studied and how it's studied. Do you ever worry about those kinds of things? I mean, I realize what you're doing is just at a very different level, very far removed from trying to understand how humans behave. But I'm just wondering your thoughts on all of those very complex questions.
In the last 20 years or so, we have learned that things manifest differently. Behaviors manifest differently in males and females. And prior to those 20 or 30 years, we were just not asking the right questions of the right sex. So we use the same question for males and females, and one or the other sex would do better. We now know that, you know, males on average are good at following a map geometrically, turn right here, go straight here, take a U-turn there, et cetera, et cetera. But women are better at using landmarks to get to where they're going. So it's two different strategies that the sexes are employing in order to get to the same goal. And we have to be very, very careful to make sure that we are looking for these differences, because they are so easy to miss if you just ignore one sex.
Yeah. And for example, between my husband and myself, what you just described would be exactly the opposite. So, of course, the individual is really, you know, at the individual level, of course, and you're being very careful to point that out all the time. Terry shared with me an article that was very interesting and also disturbing about some of what is now known about the effects of estrogen on the brain and how women do seem to be subject to some health risks from all that estrogen running around the brain for so long. I'm wondering if you have any knowledge about that and what you could tell us about both what those risks are and what the steps are to kind of improve outcomes in that area.
Absolutely. So at the outset of this answer, I will say that estrogens are soluble in fats and oils and not soluble in water. Every single cell in our body has a fatty membrane around it. And what that means is that estrogen can go everywhere in the body if it just dissolves in those fat membranes. So the challenge, actually, for us scientists is how do we deliver estrogens to where they are needed and only to where they are needed? So in terms of the brain, it seems like estrogens are a good thing. They improve spatial memory. They keep appetite low and energy loss high. These are all good things. But in the periphery, in the body, estrogens can be very dangerous. Ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, breast cancer, all these three types of cancers are often very, very responsive to estrogens. In fact, one of the clear treatments for women who develop a lot of these cancers is to get rid of the source of estrogen by performing an ovariectomy, to get rid of the fuel that these cancer cells like so much. So, you know, if we could just give women estrogens, that would be great. But we can't do it because there's also these risks of cancers in the body. The biggest challenge for scientists right now, as I said, is figuring out a way to specifically deliver estradiol, estrogens, to the target that where it does favorable things and avoid targets where it is dangerous.
So, Colin, is the case there where testosterone, in some cases in males, can also facilitate the growth of cancer cells? Is that correct?
It is absolutely correct. So it's prostate cancer, for example, is highly, very often, highly responsive to testosterone. The use of enzyme inhibitors, receptor blockers, that is also one of the treatments for prostate cancers.
I want to bring up a really controversial topic. You know, I don't know how comfortable or how much you know about this, but Terry and I beforehand, when we were getting ready to talk to you, we were just talking about the wave of sex change therapy. And my first question is it the case that people who are in one sex body but feel themselves to be the other, can you see a difference in their balance of hormones? Is that part of it, or is it not really related to hormonal differences among people?
As best we can tell, differences in hormones do not explain gender dysmorphia, or what we call trans. We know it exists. We absolutely know it exists. There are transsexual individuals. In fact, a really important study about 3 or 4 years ago, done in the Netherlands, I believe, the scientist's name was Julie Bakker. The Netherlands are known for their meticulous, detailed information about citizens, and it's been very useful. What the scientist did is that she found groups of girls and boys who were either cis, girls who thought of themselves as girls, and boys who thought of themselves as boys, and trans, girls who thought of themselves as boys, and boys who thought of themselves as girls. What Julie did was she put these individuals into a functional MRI and allowed them to smell an odor which is only detectable by one sex and very rarely by the other. So this pheromone, is detected by girls and women and often ignored by boys and men. What she saw in the functional MRI was that girls who thought of themselves as girls, their brains reacted to this pheromone as expected, and boys who thought of themselves as boys tended to ignore it, and not much happened in response to the pheromone. The really interesting thing that emerged from this paper was that the girls who thought of themselves as boys, so trans boys, did not respond to this odor. And boys who thought of themselves as girls, so trans girls, did respond to the odor. What I mean here is that the brains of trans individuals were responding to the gender that they thought of themselves as, not the sex that they were. So that is, to me, the most compelling evidence that there are differences in the trans brain. And in this case, they map perfectly on to sex differences in brains in general.
Wow, is that fascinating. So something's going, you don't know what's going on, but there is something sort of biologically different there, but you just
there
don't
seems
understand.
To be.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, we don't know it.
Wow.
So, Colin, the MRIs didn't reveal any anatomical or structural differences, say specific areas of the brain that differed between those subjects in that study?
As far as I remember, the answer was no. This was also a very specific study where the scientist was looking at the part of the brain that we knew was responsive to this odor in females. So a lot of it was focused on this one part of the brain. And so, I mean, they had a lot of other data, but I do not remember any structural differences that were pointed out in that particular study.
So interesting. So here's my question. And again, I may be asking you to span just far too many, a much too large gap between science and policy and medicine. But in terms of people who are transitioning and more transitioning at quite a young age with, you know, hormone replacement and that kind of thing, are there medical concerns that need to be attended to? And if so, is there any knowledge at this point about how to attend to those concerns, how to protect the brains of trans people from, you know, the effects of transitioning?
I am not as familiar with this area as I'd like to be. From what I understand, though, having a couple of trans friends myself, there is constant vigilance. Once the individual goes on hormone therapy, there is constant vigilance, checking up the risk factors to make sure nothing goes awry. This is particularly important for trans women, whose bodies have not experienced much estradiol ever. And all of a sudden, they're now taking relatively high amounts of estrogens and perhaps even progesterone. And so their bodies may respond very, very differently than bodies that have been exposed to estrogens all their life. In these individuals in particular, medical checkups at short intervals is very, very necessary. And I believe that is what is done in this case.
Fascinating. It's an example of how science can really, you know, make a difference as we try to create more humane environments for people to live their lives. Really fascinating work. Anyway, go ahead, Terry.
So we focused a lot on humans, but there are certainly animal models. And actually, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the value of the animal models for understanding basically neuroendocrinology to begin with. And also maybe go back to the question of trans with respect to, do you see species other than humans indications of transgender phenomenon?
So that is a very interesting question. And the answer is, we don't know. And the reason, there's multiple reasons for this. So you're right. The literature is rife with animal models in neuroendocrinology, all the way from macaque monkeys, all the way to insects even. And that, of course, is because there are a lot of interesting studies that we just cannot do in humans. It's either too risky or it's unethical, and we just cannot perform these experiments, and we should not perform these experiments in humans. On the question of trans, one of the biggest difficulties, and I'll give you a very flippant answer first and then a serious one later, we don't know much about trans animals because we don't speak their language. And they can't tell us. This is particularly important for gender, not sex, but gender, because gender is believed to be a performance that we as humans engage in order so that the world sees us as male or female. By that, I mean wearing dresses as opposed to pants, or having putting on makeup versus not, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And since gender is such a social construct, I believe we have to be incredibly intelligent to ask that question of non-human animals.
That makes sense. Though, you know, I used to spend a lot of time with horses, and there were mares who, you know, behave like stallions. And I always thought, oh, there's a trans horse. But I could be wrong. But I guess that's not very good evidence, right?
Oh, no, actually, it's you're closer to the truth than you think. There's a researcher out in Oregon. His name is Dr. Roselli, who has been studying sheep for the last 10 or 15 years. So apparently, farmers have known this for centuries, that there are some rams that prefer to mount other rams as opposed to ewes. And Roselli has been asking the question, what is different in the brains of what he calls female-oriented rams versus male-oriented rams? Now, I believe it's safe to say that he is looking at this through the lens of sexual orientation, not gender. I think that's an accurate statement. I think he would agree. But I don't know anyone who's actually, again, because gender is different from sex and gender is so socially driven, I don't believe there's much work using animal models on gender.
It'll be a very long time before anybody's really able to figure out how to do that. But all really so fascinating. You know, I realize we jumped into all of these big questions without really getting a chance to talk to you about what your specific current and upcoming research is. I'm just curious to know more about where you're headed in your own research career.
Okay. So as I said earlier, I'm very interested in the specificity of steroid delivery, in this case, estrogens. And work in my lab occurs in two different topics. The first one is the specificity of estrogen provision. We found about 20 years ago now, when I was a postdoc at UCLA, that in addition to neurons in the brain that could synthesize estrogen, this enzyme that converted testosterone to estrogen was localized to synapses, actual connections between neurons. And that is a very, very specific way of delivering estrogens. We have used that idea to study the role of estrogens on spatial memory in a part of the brain that we know is very important for spatial memory, and importantly, where synaptic aromatase, synaptic estrogen synthesis, is very, very high. So we are able to inhibit aromatase in this particular brain area and show that spatial memory is impaired. We are also able to increase estrogen in this particular area and show that spatial memory is restored. That's one area of the lab. The other area of the lab studies the neuroprotection afforded by estrogen. Again, about 20 years ago, we discovered that in the animal that I studied, and I'll tell you more about it in a second, a mechanical injury, not very different from a traumatic brain injury in humans, a penetrating brain injury in our animals resulted in a very dramatic surge of estrogen synthesis right around the wound. And we have learned that that increase in estrogen synthesis right at the injury site is very important to protect the brain from further damage. It slows down cell death. It increases cell birth and cell migration to the area of the injury. And we also know that it decreases neuroinflammation. So the second part of the lab studies the role of estrogen synthesis in neuroprotection using the same animals that I have studied all my career. And this animal is the songbird. It's a songbird. The species is zebra finches. They are native to the Australian outback, but they have been used in neuroendocrine research since the very first publication of functional brain differences in any vertebrate, which was published in 1976. And They are excellent models for several reasons. One, the male sings, the female never sings. So there's a stark sex difference in behavior. If you hear zebrafin song, you know it's a male, because females have never been seen to sing. They also look very different. Males have these orange cheek patches. They have zebra stripes, hence their name, on their chests. Their beaks are redder than female beaks, which are more orange. And females lack those cheek patches completely. We also know that that behavioral sex difference in singing is reflected in differences in structure. So there are parts of the zebrafinch male brain that are important for learning song and actually singing as an adult that are 3 to 5 times larger in the male brain compared to the same brain areas in the female. So this animal model has provided researchers with really excellent cues as to what we need to look for to understand sex differences in behavior, sex differences in neuronal structure, sex differences in hormones, and now sex differences and just general, the role of estrogens on neuroprotection and memory.
So, Colin, this makes me think of an area where there seems to be sex differences, and it seems to be related to neuroprotection and certainly memory function. And that is, in humans, the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, about 2/3 of those cases are female, and the 1/3 are male. And as I understand it, it's not just based on the differences in longevity. There's something else going on. Do you have any sense about what could be a basis for those differences?
There was a hypothesis floating around, and it's been around for about 30 years now, that it is estrogen in females that is protecting the brain until the menopause. And when that estrogen goes down after the menopause, females tend to develop Alzheimer's-like symptoms much more than men. So that may be one reason that once that protection has gone away around age 50 or 55 or so, the incidence of Alzheimer's-like behaviors seems to go up in women, higher incidence of women relative to men. Also, women who go on hormone replacement therapy seem to have a lower incidence for Alzheimer's than age-matched women who do not go on hormone replacement therapy. There are very few studies documenting this, but they are around. And that may be one reason why you see the incidence of Alzheimer's higher in females.
So one question that raises is, so the loss of estrogen is responsible for perhaps the emergence of Alzheimer's symptoms or other types of dementia. But of course, males don't have as much estrogen. They wouldn't have this kind of loss of estrogen. So I don't understand that if they don't have the protection of estrogen, why are they less influenced or affected by that disease? You have any thoughts on that?
I don't know that we have an answer to that. What you're describing, what we are talking about actually is very similar to conversations that we had about heart disease about 40 years ago. It was exactly the same thing, except that men were having heart attacks more often than females. We've now come to realize that, again, heart attacks manifest differently in males and females. So one possibility is that either the hormonal bases of behaviors that are affected in Alzheimer's have a different mechanism in males compared to females. That's certainly possible. We also have to consider the possibility that we're using the wrong tests to compare between the sexes, as we spoke of earlier. You know, this is all made even more complex by the fact that the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is a postmortem diagnosis. And so we don't really have ways of looking at the brain directly in the living Alzheimer's patient, other than functional brain imaging, but that the resolution is not good at all. In the absence of those tools, it's very difficult for us to compare between the sexes in the living Alzheimer's patient.
That's right. All right. You can see the behavioral manifestations of it for sure, but you're not exactly sure if it's the product of the plaques and tangles that seem to be
exactly
the main feature of Alzheimer's. So just one more question, and that is testosterone at all protective? Well, the reason I ask that is because we males don't have, I mean, there is a reduction of testosterone, but it's not as dramatic as occurs in estrogen in menopause.
That's correct. So there are studies that either show no effect of testosterone on protection, studies that show a small level of protection, and studies that show that there are bad things that happen with high testosterone. But remember, yes, males have testosterone flowing around in the body and it goes down with age. But remember that in the brain, that testosterone can be converted to estrogen in the human male brain as well. So we may not be looking at the right product when we look at testosterone. We need to be looking at estrogen levels. And again, unfortunately, we have no way of figuring out what the level of estrogen is in the brain of a living person. We can get some idea by cerebrospinal fluid with the spinal tap, you know, but that, again, that's not neural levels. That's just closer to neural levels. So we need to figure out a way that we can measure the level of estrogen in the living human brain. And there is one researcher who's actually doing it, and she has some marvelous results.
Very interesting. That's always been intrigued me in terms of, because, you know, Colin, I actually studied hippocampus, which is a target of these diseases, and I'm very interested in your work in terms of the protective effects of estrogen. But there's still obviously a number of questions that are right now beyond our grasp. The answers are anyway.
So, Colin, are you continuing along these lines with the zebra finches? Is that kind of where you see your research headed in the next 5 to 10 years, or are you branching out, or are you not sure? How do you decide what your next topic is?
Well, I see myself sticking with this animal model for sure, and for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. They're just such fantastic animal models to use when you're asking questions about estrogen, the brain, and behavior. I do see myself continuing this area of research, particularly the one of synaptic estrogen synthesis. That, to me, is to put it bluntly, very cool, because we didn't know that this happened 15, 20 years ago. And we're still trying to figure out what that estrogen synthesis at the synapse actually does. And so my lab right now is asking questions about the role of the interaction between electrical signaling in the neuron and estrogen synthesis at the synapse. We're also studying, as Terry mentioned, the brain area, the hippocampus, which is where we can inhibit estrogen synthesis and show deficits in spatial memory. We are using genomics to try and understand how estrogens may be having this beneficial effect on learning and memory. As far as I can tell, the zebra finch is the one that seems to provide us with a stronger animal model with which to do this research. I'll give you an example from the neuroprotection field. You know, a mechanical injury in mammals, rats, mice, also results in an upsurge of estrogen in the brain, but it takes about 5 to 10 days. In our zebra finches, it takes less than 24 hours. So put bluntly, I can do an experiment much faster in zebra finches and get an answer much faster relative to using a mammalian model. And that's why I choose to stick with the zebra finch. Also, in terms of the ability of the brain to synthesize estrogen, these birds are higher by far in, they make much more estrogen in their brains than any mammal that we know of. And so, you know, if something is higher or bigger or louder, it's easier to study because you can measure it more easily. And that's why I see myself sticking with zebra finches, because they have these wonderful characteristics.
It all sounds so interesting and important, and I wish you all the luck in the world in continuing down this line of research. It really, who knows what wonderful things will come out of it. Terry, do you have any other questions? We're kind of...
Yeah, we're starting to run out of time. Yeah, Colin, I have kind of a general question, and that is, as scientists, what we try to do is provide very accurate picture of reality. And again, quite often we're not saying we have facts. We just have things that we have different levels of confidence in. And the things that we have most confidence in, this is what we are based on a lot of testing and so on. In the era of COVID, and there are a number of different kinds of phenomenon, it seems that the valuation of our work is not based on the quality of our data, but often on social, religious, and or political beliefs of the public. And I'm wondering, in your field, and perhaps even your own research, do you think that that is a potential source of worry or an issue that, that scientists need to address?
Absolutely. It is a constant source of worry. And scientists and government and policymakers need to be heavily invested in forming policy and any other sort of interventions solidly based in science. And I think there's two ways we can do this. Us as scientists need to be much more out there sharing information with in public venues. I mean, we do it in college, we do it in graduate school, but we rarely do things like this, where we have an opportunity to talk about our science in a manner that is understandable by someone without the training that we've had. The other side of the coin, I think, is even more important. And that is, we need to have people who understand science in positions of authority when it comes to policy and government, because all these data need to be interpreted correctly. And we need scientists at the level of government to be able to do this. Right now, it's actually quite shocking to see the low number of scientists or even medical doctors in government itself. And that seems like it could be ameliorated, the bad effects could be ameliorated by putting people who understand science into these positions of authority.
That sounds like a great idea. Yeah, I guess, yeah it's a two-edged sword because, as Terry and I have been exploring in this podcast, sometimes leaping too quickly to policy, right, without understanding the limits and the tentativeness of what scientists are discovering produces its own set of problems. And so I can see, especially in talking about your fascinating research, some of the reasons why keeping it at the level of science at this point makes a lot of sense. So it doesn't become embroiled in the culture wars, so that, you know, knowledge for knowledge's sake can be pursued. I take everything that you're saying, but I also am learning from you some of the reasons to stay in at the level of science until it's really time to move to translating into policy.
Agreed.
So yeah, one of the problems though is that a lot of times science becomes clickbait. And we see headlines that I'm just very disappointed to see. Where it's exaggerated. And what makes me concerned is that people who are in policy positions, are they actually getting, is that what they're seeing? Is that their basis for understanding? Or they actually have a chance to have someone who can interpret the data more carefully and accurately so they can use it? And that I don't know the answer to, but I think what both Susan and I are interested in is trying to find a way that we can get the best information that can be used to form the best policies.
Yes, it is very important. And I think there are more and more attempts by government and policymakers to interface with scientists and clinicians. I would love to see more of it.
Okay, Susan, do you have anything more?
No. And in fact, I think that sounds like a really great point to end this fascinating discussion on. And thank you so much. This was just amazing.
Yes. Thank you, Colin. Yeah. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me on. This was very, very enjoyable.
Well, that's it for this podcast episode. Thanks very much for listening. And as always, we welcome your feedback at neuroscience.policy@american.edu. We hope you'll join us again for our next episode, and do let us know if there's anything in particular you'd like to hear more about.